Welcome to the THA-TDH Weekly COVID-19 call. My name is Richard, and I'll be your operator for today's call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. During the question-and-answer session, if you have a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I'll now turn the call over to Chris Clark with the Tennessee Hospital Association. You may begin.
Thank you, Richard. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our weekly call for the Hospital Association with our partners at the Tennessee Department of Health. We apologize for a little bit of delay this morning. 10 o'clock is a popular hour, and a lot of national calls are being conducted with all of us working from home and making other arrangements. So appreciate your patience as we got everybody engaged and on the line this morning. Just one quick housekeeping note while it's top of the hour is, we are planning to continue to host weekly calls with the Department of Health and THA ongoing from now through the end of May. In that first series of calls, today would be the last in that first series. So in your reminder, you should have noted the opportunity to register for the next month's worth of calls, and I would encourage you to go ahead and do so, and we'll send that link out again after today's call with the recording. But you will need to re-register so that it populates your calendar for each weekly call going forward through the month of May. And we so appreciate the Department of Health and their willingness to have this opportunity to share on a weekly basis with our membership. With that, this morning we have Dr. Mary Margaret Phil and Dr. Amelia Keaton from the Department of Health, and I'm going to turn it over to Mary Margaret.
Hi, everyone. Good morning and happy Friday. We have just a few updates today. I don't think we have a ton of information to share. We do recognize that there are a lot of questions around reopening and resumption of procedures and elective procedures and things like that, and we will do our very best to answer questions that you might have, but I will sort of preface the talk today by saying that at this point, you know, there is a lot of conversation with leadership and the executive team and the state, but not any formal guidance that has yet been developed, but we are happy to take, you know, questions and concerns around that topic as they arise, and certainly feed that back to leadership to ensure that that you have all of the information that you need as we look to the next coming weeks. So I want to just give a brief update first, just sort of starting with the situation update in Tennessee. As you all know, as of 2 p.m. yesterday, we had 8,266 cases in Tennessee with 170 deaths reported. In this past week, we have added some additional demographic breakdown data on our website with relation to deaths. So we now report the age range, sex, race, and ethnicity of deaths on the website. Again, just recognizing the importance of understanding if there are any underlying trends leading to higher complications and a higher fatality rate that we can identify. And we recognize that that's something that you all are closely monitoring in your patient populations and communities as you look to provide the very best care for folks that you can. I do also want to mention that we are working to revamp our website in the next week or so, hopefully. It will be much cleaner. The idea is to make it less of a single long page that you have to scroll down for 10 minutes to get to all the information, and make it much more easy to quickly find what you're looking for. We are also looking to add several other additional data elements, including basically downloadable data sets with all of the historic data for the aggregate information that we've been reporting on the website dating back to the date that it was first reported. So we recognize that this has been an ask from many different groups and health systems and communities as they look to, you know, more closely track, numbers and metrics in their communities, you know, currently and then certainly going forward as we pay such close attention to what our trends will be in the coming days and weeks and months. And so we recognize that this is a great need for people to have this historic data and then the ability to have that future data. So again, it will basically just be, you know, aggregate historic data of all of the metrics that we're presenting at the statewide level and then similarly at the county level. Breakdowns by the number of positive cases, number of cases that were tested and negative, the number of deaths, and the number of recovered individuals by county. So Hopefully that will be helpful. We hope to have that live in the next, like I said, week, maybe even sooner than that. But I did want to put that out there. We've received quite a few data requests, and we hear you and are working to make that available, as we hope it will be helpful for everyone. I do also want to piggyback on a letter that was sent out through THA, through the regional hospital coordinators, and through licensure earlier this week around reporting of COVID-specific information and hospital resource availability through the National Healthcare Safety Network, NHSN, versus our healthcare resource tracking system, HRTS. As we talked about last week, the state has assumed the responsibility of reporting those data elements to the federal government on the behalf of hospitals. We received our official certification from FEMA to do that. They've approved the data set that we're sending. And so there is no longer the requirement that hospitals have to report that COVID-specific data into NHSN. We, again, really just need you to report that data daily into HRTS, because that's the data that we're then sharing with the federal government, and B, that we're utilizing for a lot of real-time monitoring and metrics that we're looking at. So hopefully all of you received that letter and that was clear. We hope that that's helps with some of the many burdens and asks that are put on your facilities right now. I know there was also some discussion about trying to upload from our end the HRTS data into NHSN just for you guys to have access to that data in both modules. We're still looking into that to see if that might be a possibility. I think those are the two big updates that I have. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Keaton for a couple of updates from her perspective.
Hi, everyone. This is Amelia Keaton. Not a whole lot on the healthcare-associated side in terms of updates this week. Just wanted to reiterate what Dr. Phil said about trying to develop guidance for things specifically like resuming elective procedures in your facilities once the state restrictions start to open up a little bit. I think this is something that we are still trying to tackle, and I think a lot of folks are still trying to tackle in terms of how safe, what the most safe way to do this is, and also kind of the timing of that. I know the American College of Surgeons has released a general framework of things to consider if your facility is considering restarting elective procedures in the near future. And that the attempt of that document, I believe, is to try to balance the need for increased capacity to care for patients with COVID-19 while also making sure that folks who have been waiting for procedures that are considered elective are able to have those, and facilities are able to continue offering those services, as I know they've currently been delayed for quite some time right now. And I think some of the aspects that come into play is are the resources available at your facility, the transmission of COVID-19 in the community. I think we're still seeing case counts rise, and we're still seeing sustained transmission in a lot of areas. And I think the general recommendation from the American College of Surgeons is to try to wait until there's a sustained decrease in transmission in cases. And so that's something certainly to consider at your local level. Other considerations, you know, for those types of procedures include the availability of rapid testing turnaround, as we know some facilities would like to institute admission screening before doing those elective procedures. At this point, we are still, I think, at a point where testing is not as widely available as we would like it to be. We are certainly working on rapidly improving that, and I think Tennessee is in a better place than a lot of other states, but still not something that is, you know, really on scale to what we would need for really going back to business as usual in those elective procedure settings. Another thing that I just wanted to bring up that likely doesn't really impact the folks on the acute care side, but for the post-acute care folks on the call, CDC and CMS have released guidance over the past week regarding reporting specific metrics from long-term care facilities into NHSN, which is, you know, as Dr. Phil said, something that we're not requiring of long-term care, of acute care facilities at this point, but that CMS is likely going to start requiring soon of long-term care facilities. We unfortunately still don't have a lot of details on what that's going to look like, and we actually found out at about the same time as everybody else of that new requirement. And so more to come on that, but just something to be aware of, and that we are going to work as diligently as possible to make sure that we make the burden for those facilities as minimal as possible. I think just a few other things worth mentioning. We are starting to see improvements, I think, in the availability of PPE, but certainly not all aspects of it. And so just continuing to monitor CDC's website for updates on guidance such as decontamination of N95s. I think they recently updated that guidance, not with a ton of new information, but just kind of how to think about implementing those procedures such as UV light sterilization and steam sterilization and those sorts of things. And we will also try to keep you posted of any big changes that we see on that end as well. And then finally, I think we mentioned this last week, but also just reiterating that for contact tracing purposes, particularly in healthcare facilities, we are now focusing on including a period of time of 48 hours before a person reported developing symptoms or before a person tested positive for COVID-19. And that's really just to acknowledge that we know asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic transmission is possible. And so we really want to try to identify those folks who came into contact with somebody 48 hours before symptoms started or testing results came back. So just something to keep in mind. I think we had mentioned this previously, but we've now updated our guidance document on the Tennessee Department of Health website for healthcare workers who test positive for COVID-19 to reflect that change. And I think with that, I don't have anything further. Dr. Phil, is there anything more you'd like to say before we open it up for questions?
No, I don't think so. Operator, I think we can go ahead and open up the line for questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you wish to be removed from the queue, please press the pound sign or the hash key. There will be a delay before the first question is announced, and if you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up the handset first before pressing the numbers. Once again, for any questions on the line, that's star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone, and we're standing by for questions. And our first question online comes from Ann Lioncaster. Please go ahead.
Yes, I just would like some feedback on what your thoughts, all of y'all, as far as utilizing antibody testing and the sequence of whether to use antibody testing first or PCR testing if we start testing employees.
Yeah, I guess the question, do you mean is a screen to allow employees to work?
Yes, or if you're just going to do start mandatory testing of all employees and utilizing that, which would you recommend first, or just your thoughts on whether to initially do a PCR or to initially do antibody testing in that sequence?
So, I think from my perspective, and I'll certainly let Dr. Keaton or Dr. Long or others comment as well, antibody testing right now is, we recognize is becoming increasingly widespread, but I think the value of antibody testing at the individual patient level is still very uncertain. We recognize that, first of all, sort of the acute phase antibodies can be highly variable in when they appear. So we see in some people an IgM response can appear anywhere from 3 to 12 days after a patient is exposed to the virus. But I think most importantly for the question that you raised, we don't even know for sure if all of these antibody tests are very specific for the SARS-CoV-2, the virus causing COVID-19. There is suggestion of, in many of them, quite a bit of cross-reactivity with seasonal coronaviruses. So a positive test doesn't necessarily ensure that the person was even exposed to COVID-19. And secondly, we still don't really understand what a positive antibody means in terms of immunity. We don't know if these are virus neutralizing antibodies or if they are, just a marker of exposure. And so just because someone has a positive antibody, we yet don't fully understand if that means that they could not be reinfected. From our perspective, I think in public health, I think antibody testing is potentially interesting at kind of the population and community level as we try to understand how widespread the virus has potentially been in some communities recognizing that we had and still continue to have, you know, testing limitations by PCR in many areas of the country. So, but I think interpreting those tests at the individual patient level is really challenging, and I would really caution folks from jumping right to antibody testing until we better understand how to interpret those results. I will also say that I haven't checked the website again this morning, but you know, FDA as of yesterday, I think had only approved, you know, 3 antibody tests under emergency use authorization, and there are probably 100 plus that are on the market, and they are allowed to be on the market, and that's legal, but many of these tests have not been validated to look at their accuracy or specificity, and so it is really challenging to interpret potentially results from many of these tests. And so I know that FDA is looking at trying to do some more official validation and assessments of many of these tests as this field has really sort of exploded in the last couple of weeks, but all of that information is forthcoming. You know, the question about testing every employee by PCR, you know, I think we feel that that's a much better marker of acute infection, although we also recognize that, you know, depending on the study, anywhere from 10 to 20% sometimes of those tests are falsely negative. And so a lot of that, I think, probably has to do with the completeness and quality of the sample being taken. We recognize that a lot of these swabs are probably turbinate swabs or they're not true nasopharyngeal swabs. And then also, you know, there's sort of a limit of detection that's set for PCR. And so if the viral load that's detected is below that, then it's going to be negative, even if there's virus present there. So, you know, I think all of these caveats are part of why a lot of the questions being raised around, similar to employees, testing every patient that's coming in or testing every patient before elective surgery are just not really straightforward, because none of our testing is perfect. And so we really have to interpret results through the lens of all of those challenges. So I'm not really sure if that was an answer to your question, Dr. Keaton or Dr. Long or others. Do you have additional thoughts on this question?
No, I also agree that it's really difficult to interpret these tests right now. I think we have a long history of using things like measles and varicella titers to kind of help guide employee actions and employee health decisions. But I think, you know, that we were able to do that because there's been a really thorough immunologic investigation of those viruses and those illnesses in general. And we know that those antibodies are a correlate of protection. But I think, you know, we also had, you know, hundreds of years to obtain that research. I think, unfortunately, we are still only on month 5 after the virus was recognized in China. And so a lot of that immunologic research is forthcoming. And I think even if somebody tests positive for COVID-19, for, you know, in terms of IgG and IgM antibodies, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're protected, as Dr. Phil said. And I think we still need a lot more research to really know what part of the immune system provides protection, and then also how best to measure that. So I hope that, you know, antibodies are the answer, but I think we still need to have a lot more research to do before we can make that conclusion.
Thank you so much. That's extremely helpful.
Once again, for any questions on the line, that's star, then 1 on your touch-tone phone. Our next question online comes from Kelly Winston. Please go ahead.
Well, this is actually Lisa Castile with Henry County Medical Center. And I have a question about the guidelines that were to be issued this week for discharges from a hospital to a nursing home, referencing that 48-hour time frame of doing testing before you send a patient to a nursing home. Are there any updates?
Yeah, this is Amelia Keaton. So this is an area, I think, of very high interest, and I apologize for not having more firm guidelines out there. I think there's still a lot of discussions on the best way to approach these discharges. You know, I think we may at some point get to a point where testing is something that can help guide those decisions, but I think in the meantime, you know, what the Department of Health focus will be is, you know, just recommending best practices for those transfers So things like good communication from the acute care hospital to the post-acute setting, screening all discharges for symptoms of illness like respiratory distress, decreased pulse oximetry readings, new onset fevers, and just making sure that folks who do have any symptoms that weren't previously recognized are not discharged to the long-term care setting. But I think at this point, our, at least my team and folks at the Department of Health are not going to be able to make a strong recommendation in terms of facilities accepting patients or rejecting patients. I think a lot of that's going to have to be worked out between the facility and the long-term care facility. With that said, though, we understand that transfers are a problem across the board and want to make sure that we are as thoughtful as possible about that and also include, you know, all sides of the transfer in those discussions. And I think that's something that's ongoing at this point.
And thank you. Once again, for any questions, that's star, then one on your touchtone phone. Okay, it looks like we have no questions in queue at this time.
Thank you, operator. While people think about if there's other things they want to ask, if Dr. Long is still able to stay on the phone, Wendy, did you want to discuss or mention THA's principles that were submitted to Unified Command around the resumption of elective surgery?
Sure, I'm happy to just briefly mention them. The Tennessee Hospital Association Board of Directors yesterday unanimously approved a set of principles or guidelines for returning to elective surgery and procedures, and we have submitted those to Unified Command. Basically, they, without going into a lot of detail, just highlight the need for hospitals to be reporting into HRTS on a daily basis, because as we make this move, it will be more important than ever to have an accurate data system that reflects what's going on in hospitals across the state. They talk about the importance of a district approach and that hospitals within districts are meeting on a regular basis as we begin to implement elective procedures again, and that decisions about the approach that's taken relative to elective procedures, how those are phased in, should ideally be a district-level approach. They talk about the requirements for hospitals to assess their PPE situation, have adequate inventories on hand, a plan for conserving PPE, a reliable supply chain. Testing, the issue of testing is addressed more from the perspective of every hospital needing to have a plan for whom and when they're going to test, but it does allow for some variation across hospitals in terms of the testing protocol that they want to implement. We know that some hospitals are considering testing everybody before an elective procedure. Others are looking at more of a symptom and risk-based based testing with just universal appropriate precautions. There's a section on environmental mitigation talking about the continued need to have limitation of visitors and to assure that appropriate protective equipment are worn by staff. A discussion of just how we assure a responsible restart. So the need to be sure that surgeons and patients are having discussions about end-of-life care and advanced directives, making sure that if you're getting ready to do a procedure that's going to require a stay in a post-acute setting like a SNF, that you have had those discussions in advance and know that you have a plan for discharge before you would elect to do a procedure like that, given the challenges that we're having. And then it goes on to require a phased-in approach. So clearly, as has already been mentioned on this call, nobody needs to be contemplating moving from our current incredibly low census levels to a rate of performing these procedures that would fill your beds overnight. And so it is written in a way to allow that phased approach to vary from hospital to hospital or district to district, but there has to be a plan for a phase-in. So whether or not you may have some districts that say we're going to start with procedures that have a minimal to low impact on inpatient hospital bed capacity and that utilize minimal amounts of PPE with an intent to move to more complex procedures later on in a later phase. Another option would be to begin with some districts believe they should begin with the more intensive procedures because they are more necessary, if you will, and a later phase would bring in these lower complexity and more elective, if you will, procedures. Another way to phase would be around your OR schedule and not, you know, only operating some fraction of your ORs initially with a plan to open additional ORs later. I think in the Davidson area, they're considering some age-based criteria. So you might start with procedures in individuals under the age of, say, 70, and a later phase, you move to older individuals. But basically, these guidelines just require that each hospital has that plan to phase in, and also that plan includes the triggers that would signal a need to pull back in response to a surge in patients. And then finally, that between these phases, there is a requirement that an analysis really be undertaken by the hospital, that you are constantly watching the data, and that to the extent you begin to see a surge in patients or you're using a larger percentage of your hospital beds than you've identified as your goal, that you would perform this analysis before you would make that decision to move into a next phase. So we'll be circulating that, I think, with our daily COVID communication today for anybody who hasn't already seen it. But really think it was great work by the board to be able to come together and endorse something unanimously as they did yesterday.
Thanks so much, Wendy. I know several people on the call may not have been as familiar with that as the board members were, so I appreciate that. That overview for those on the call. Operator, would you like to see if there's other questions at this time?
Yes, so we do have a question online from Randy Davis. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So this is Randy at Northcrest in Springfield. For the Department of Health, first of all, y'all have done a great job in increasing the amount of information that's out on your website and that good thing. So thank you for that. I also understand the downside of that is the more information that you put out, and I know this is frustrating to y'all, is the more questions, the more information that's wanted. Was curious, early in April, several of the metro areas put out hotspot maps around the positive cases, and didn't know if that was in the future, even if it's just working through our EMAs, local EMAs, to be able to have access to that type of data as we look at expanding our testing. Sometimes even the cold spots raise more questions as to did we actually test anyone in those cold spots? And just didn't know if there was an opportunity to be able to do something like that so we can be a little bit more targeted in our communities.
Hi, yeah, absolutely. So this is Dr. Phil. We are in that sort of website upgrade that we're looking to do as soon as possible. We plan to include sort of two types of maps. So the first will be kind of an interactive map with the ability to filter by the whole state, by our public health regions, or by county. And you can look at both positivity rates of testing as well as the total number tested. And those are all going to be rates, so by population. You know, we recognize that numbers of tests are great, but it's really important to consider the size of the underlying community and population to really have a meaningful way to compare from the big metros to our more rural communities. So that I think will be helpful. Similarly, we have a statewide map that's sort of that heat map in a slightly different form, but very similar concept that some of the metros have done, looking at those trends by zip code. So it will be a little bit more granular. I will also say that those, you know, we don't necessarily plan to push out publicly, but we're working to ensure that our local public health partners have that the sort of zip code level data provided to them so that they can help make decisions and advise partners and things like that. I think it's just a bit much to put more, you know, 13 more granular maps on the website. But we certainly plan to have that sort of county, region, statewide level, again, both by positivity rate and testing rates, and then also the zip code stratification. So hopefully that will be helpful. And then, you know, if there are other specific, you know, data needs, you know, certainly reach out to your, you know, local health departments, and they can communicate with us, and we can try to ensure that you have access to the data that you need.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
And once again, it's a reminder to attendees, for any questions or comments, that's star, then one on your touchtone phone. And I'm showing we have no questions in queue.
Thank you, operator. Dr. Keaton or Dr. Phil, do you have additional comments or things that you would like to share with the group this morning?
I don't think I have.
Was that a collective no?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Sorry, a collective no.
Okay, great. Again, we appreciate everyone being on the phone today, and as always, we appreciate the opportunity to interact with both Dr. Phil and Dr. Keaton at the Department of Health. As others have mentioned, we so appreciate the opportunity to work with you and your responsiveness to all the many questions and trying to make resources available to all the constituents across the state, and so we appreciate that. And hope that perhaps this weekend, as others on the phone, perhaps as Dr. Long told our group earlier today, perhaps we can take a pause and regroup as we begin to look at chapter two of our response to this pandemic. So thank you all for being on the call today. If you have questions and follow-up, please let us know, and we'd be happy to get those to Dr. Keaton and Dr. Phil. So with that, operator, I think that concludes our call. Thank you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.